This passage this morning, Mark chapter 5, verses 21 to 43, is one of those passages that reminds me of how marvelous Jesus is. And it also reminds me as well of the wonder of the Scriptures. This is a powerful, powerful story, or actually a couple of stories. What we're going to see here is a phenomenon known as the Markan sandwich. Mark was notorious for this. He would, as he painted a picture, he would actually put it in like sandwich form. So he starts out with one story, and then we have a break in the story and a focus on a different story, and then we return to the story that he started with. So you have the two buns on the beginning and the end, and in the middle you've got not necessarily the meat, but the filling of the story. It's not a statement on the importance of either stories. It's just a stylistic thing that Mark has going for him. It's called the Markan sandwich. You can get one of those today at Olive Grove Church on special today. I should have advertised that. On special, a Markan sandwich. So as we read this story, and I'm going to do it the same way we did last week. I'm just going to kind of walk through and make comments as we read. It's just a marvelous, marvelous story. So you remember from last week that Jesus crossed the Sea of Galilee into Gentile territory, and he cast out a legion of demons from a man, a Gentile. And a couple things I want to remind you of because they will play into today's story. First of all, we talked about the Gerasene demoniac being hyper unclean. Remember, he lives in the tombs. The tombs and the place of the dead would have made him unclean just to come in contact with them. But the fact that he's actually living there makes him further unclean. Death surrounds him, even in the sense that what he's filled with is not the spirit of the living God, but a demon that is intent on destroying him. So there is this high emphasis on death and uncleanness. The strength of the demoniac is emphasized. You remember we talked about the emphasis of those five things that pointed out his strength in verses 3 and 4. That there was just this hyper strength associated with them. And then the language that I want you to be reminded of. There is the language of exorcism and the beseeching and the begging. I implore you, I implore you, I beg you. Those are the language that is appealed to there repeatedly. Those themes, I raise them because they're continued here in this passage. Also, you remember that contradiction of here you've got this demoniac out of control. When he runs to Jesus, apparently to confront him, he falls to his knees. And again, we will see that posture in everyone that encounters Jesus here in this story as well. So let's begin. Matthew chapter 5, starting with verse 21, says, when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, now he's back in Israel, a large crowd gathered around him. And so he stayed by the seashore. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and on seeing him, and there it is, fell at his feet, and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live. Now, you notice that I've got the word saved there, the words get well in parentheses and the word saved. There's always a challenge in translating from one language to another. And words have a range of meaning, and they have a range of meaning that are determined by the context. And so it would be appropriate for this word saved here to be translated get well. We're talking about someone who's sick. But I made a point of noting it for you because there is an emphasis in this passage of Scripture on this word saved. There is a very high salvation theme that runs through this. Now, obviously, the means by which it's being communicated is the healing of some sort of physical ailment or sickness. But there are other words that could have been used here to talk about healing or sickness. And Mark makes sure that he uses this word, and I'll point it out to you repeatedly in this context, of saved. He wants you to see that this is a saving action, that there is a salvation intent in the story. So really we should read this so that she will be saved and live. So we have this again as we come in contrast with the story of the demoniac, that demon possession was destroying him and condemning him. And here we want to see Jesus as the one who gives life and who gives salvation. Verse 24, and he went off with him. Jesus went off with him, went with Jairus, heading towards his house. There's a sense of urgency here. My daughter is going to die, and I want you to come and to heal her. And so Jesus goes with him. And it says here that a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. And really the sense is that this is a crushing crowd. The people are just, I mean, they're just all around. I think the best way to picture this is Disneyland during Christmas. You know, if you decide to go to Disneyland during Christmas, you deserve what you get. But that's the kind of thing, it's just like there is nowhere to go and nowhere to move. This crowd is crushing him. It's this overbearing sense of presence all around him. And then here in verses 25 to 27, and I hope this page or these things come out. Well, we'll start here. A woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years. Now, before we go on, I'm going to get to had a hemorrhage. You see there is in yellow, and I want you to notice that. We're going to go on to the next slide. It doesn't have this one, but I'm going to talk about five things that are described here for her. And the 12 years is important. It's going to connect us back a little bit later in the story to the girl. The girl is 12 years old, and this woman has had this hemorrhage for 12 years. So both of these things started, or the girl was born at the same time that this illness started in this woman. It connects it just by virtue of the fact that you know, we have these two things, but you never want to just see in the Bible that things like this are referenced for us for coincidence only. It's not just a curiosity or what's that game? Trivial. It's not a trivial idea. It's not just given to us so we know how to answer something on Jeopardy. There's specific reasons that we're given these kinds of details. And the biggest reason that I could land on was this, is that we've come back to the nation of Israel, and the nation of Israel is typically seen in the scriptures by the number 12. The 12 tribes of Israel typically typify that. So whenever you have symbolic numbers, they typically address that. So the 12 tribes, the 12 leaders, the fullness of the nation of Israel would be symbolized by the 12. The 12 apostles then in the book of Revelation would symbolize the fullness of the church. But nonetheless, 12 years, so this is happening in Israel, and specifically in an Israeli context, in a Jewish context, in a law context, this hemorrhage that this woman had was a problem of uncleanness. So when a woman had a flow or an issue of blood, that caused her to be unclean. So the passage that's up here is from Leviticus. It's chapter 22. It says, when a woman has a discharge, if her discharge in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. Now, if a woman has a discharge of her blood many days, not at the period of her menstrual impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond that period, all the days of her impure discharge she shall continue as though in her menstrual impurity. She's unclean. My apologies for raising this subject this morning. But nonetheless, this would have been a time of uncleanness for a woman. And any contact with her would share that uncleanness. So if you sat where she sat, laid where she laid, touched anything that she touched, you would be considered unclean. You would have to go through a process, a sacrificial ceremonial process, to reverse that uncleanness. So every month, ladies, you would have to offer some sort of sacrifice for your uncleanness, and you'd be praising God when you hit menopause. I don't have to do that anymore. Okay? So this was a problem. And so you can see how this woman has a serious problem. An ongoing, serious problem. Because this is more than just her regular cycle. This is an ongoing bleeding, which basically the story is telling us made her continuously unclean. So she probably would never be able to go to temple, never be able to participate in any of the functions of her culture, any of the holidays, any of those things. She would have been isolated, very similar to a leper. Now, tradition tells us this woman may have lived in a town called Caesarea Philippi. And it's hard to tell how much value to place on some of these traditions. But there was actually a historian named Eusebius said that in the city of Caesarea Philippi, which is in the north part of Israel, that there was actually a copper statue made of this woman on her knees, extending herself out to touch Jesus. And we don't know, though, where she was from. If she had been from the region that she was in, many of the people would have known her, and she would have had to approach Jesus in secrecy. She would have had to have cloaked herself, disguised herself in some way, because everybody would have known her and would have been avoiding her. So apparently, if tradition has it right, she's traveled to a different town so that she can come and approach Jesus. This woman is acting in such a way that could potentially be dangerous for her. All of this so that she might touch Jesus. Now, I've got the word "had a hemorrhage" in yellow, and on the next slide, I'm going to have a bunch of other participles, they are in the Greek, also highlighted. This passage has five participles that your English translation just basically translates as verbs. So, Jim, if you go to the next slide, all of these things are described here, and in English, they just kind of all get lost as descriptions of the woman. So she had a hemorrhage. That was the first thing. And we're going to have five things, just like we had five things for the demoniac. She had a hemorrhage. She had endured much at the hands of many physicians. Now, that's a scary phrase, thinking about 2,000 years ago. Doctors, I mean, some of the stories about what they might have tried with her, giving her a glass of wine filled with something similar to rubber so that she might drink it, apparently thinking that, you know, that would soak it or block it or clog it or something, you know. There's lots of crazy stuff they did. They also took onion skins and boiled them in wine, and you know, they had just had all kinds of different notions and potions about what might help her. And you can just imagine she would try just about anything. So she had endured quite a bit at the hands of many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was not helped at all. So she's laid out a lot of money, and she'd grown worse. And then finally, after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him. And the important primary word in all of this description, and in the Greek language, it's difficult to see how this is not emphatic. In English, we could lose it, but not in the Greek. She touched him. And that highlights this, no, don't do that. You can't do that. If you touch him, he's unclean. And that would have been the legal determination. And at this point, all of these people around, Jesus is heading towards this guy's house. He's a synagogue official. And this woman, who is bleeding and unclean, touches Jesus. So she does it in secret. But the touching is the important thing. It's the highlight. And really the emphasis of this whole passage is this emphasis on the woman touching Jesus, and she just touches his outer garment. Just his outer garment. And that's enough. Verse 28. For she thought, if I just touch his garments, I will get well. Or I will be saved. Again, that word is used there. Immediately, the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed permanently of her affliction, or her whipping, her scourging, her lashing. All of this language is hyperbolic, meaning that it's extreme. So what is considered a flow of blood, if it was a fountain, she would be dead. Her hemorrhaging had to be of such a nature that it wasn't so much that she would have lost all of her blood and died. So when the text describes it as a fountain, it's an exaggeration, and that exaggeration is designed to conjure up in our minds something other than simply the healing. All of these words speak to us about the majestic healing or saving nature of Jesus Christ. He heals her. Really, he saves her. And it is really the fountain of his blood and his scourging by which he heals. So these references really actually point us ahead to Jesus' crucifixion, his suffering, and his shedding of blood for us. And this is the means by which Jesus is going to make Israel clean. Because the nation is in need of salvation. And so this woman really stands for the whole, the nation as a whole, which is why the word, or the number 12, is assigned to her and to her suffering. It's because this story not only is a marvelous story about Jesus engaging with this individual and healing her and her faith, but it's also about Jesus' mission to come and to save the nation. So all of these words serve that function. So even today we sing about, I was raised in a good Baptist church. We sang good blood songs. There is a fountain filled with blood that flows from Emmanuel's veins. You know, I don't know if the writer got it from here, but that's that picture, is that this fountain of blood is what saves us. And this word also then would lead us to other pictures, springs of living water. And so is there this correspondence where the blood actually fulfills that promise of springs of living water that will bring salvation as well. And that picture is used vibrantly in the book of Revelation and in some of the prophetic Old Testament books as well, including the book of Ezekiel, that out of Jerusalem would flow springs of water. And so this fountain, this almost in reverse here, her fountain of blood, her suffering is stopped, is finished. Jesus takes that upon himself and offers his own blood as suffering for us. And so her affliction is also seen as a whipping or a lashing. That is the literal term that's there. It's the term that is used for whipping. But you see how this story, if you actually literally translated it, people would kind of go, I don't understand what that means. So the translators of the English language have tried to help you and just put it into a healing context. Sometimes, the language, the Greek language, the backgrounds help us. And here in this story, it really helps us a lot. And so you want to kind of make those notations in your text if you can. And just to remind yourself that these are pretty clear references to the salvation impact of this story. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" Now, this is fascinating. So this is just, and the disciples, you know, they kind of respond the same way we kind of do. What do you mean, who touched you? The crowd is pressing in on you. You're at Disneyland, right? And it's like, who touched me? Don't touch me! You know, who touched me? It's an odd question. And it's not just even who touched me, it's who touched my clothes. So here in this response, you have so many things going on, because the power comes from him, and Jesus, you can only take this in one of two ways. At that point, his humanity, and in his humanity, he's not aware of it, or he's just kind of playing along for the crowd. That he, as she touches him, knows that she touches him, and the power comes from him, and he knows the power comes from him. He's aware of all of that. Or that in his humanity, the Father is acting, and he actually does turn around and say, "Who touched me?" knowing that someone had touched him. It's just a weird kind of passage when you think about the omniscience of God, how that works within Christ. And that's just one of the mysteries of the Scriptures. But nonetheless, she's healed, and he turns around and says, "Who touched my garments?" His disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. So she comes up secretly, thinking that she can touch him and be healed and go home. That is amazing faith on her part. Contextually, it's phenomenal that she would risk all of this to touch Jesus, not knowing how he would respond, not knowing what trouble she could get in. "I can just touch his garment secretly, silently. I just touched the hem of his garment. I could be healed." And so she is. Jesus looks around and he sees her. And I love that phrase. One of the phrases I started to incorporate into my thinking and my language, my communicating, and my relating to people. It reminds me of the description of God as he saw Hagar. This kind of seeing, it's not just that Jesus is turning around and wanting to know for curiosity's sake. He sees her. And I think he sees her in a way that no one has ever seen her before. He recognizes her pain. He recognizes her suffering. And he sees all that she's gone through. It's really a way that we need to start looking at people. One of the things that strikes me about this series of stories in Mark chapter 5 is how Jesus broke all of his cultural constraints about dealing with people who were before him always considered outcasts, peripheral, unclean, don't touch them, don't be around them, and I don't want to be around them. I want to make sure that I don't soil myself with those kinds of people. And it's a remarkable element of this story. If we're going to be like Jesus, I think we need to begin to see people like Jesus saw people. And so that phrase just stands out to me, that he looked around to see the woman who had done this. Now, if you stop there, there's a lot of ways you can, if you're writing this story, a lot of ways you could finish the lines. The one who did this to me, who made me unclean, who inconvenienced me. And that's not how the story's written. That's not the kind of seeing that Jesus sees. And so just really is a challenge for us as believers to begin to see people the way Jesus sees people. And so you can go through the list of people that annoy you, people that bother you, people that disgust you, people that challenge you, and begin to say, what would Jesus see in them? And how can I see what Jesus is seeing? So verse 33. But the woman, fearing and trembling, as she was right to do, I mean, that's the right conclusion she should have drawn. This rabbi now has been touched by her, and she's afraid of what's going to happen next. She wanted this to be quiet. She didn't want to have to admit what was going on. In her desperation, she was afraid and trembling, aware of what had happened to her. Apparently, she knew something experientially happened to her that convinced her of her healing. She now comes and falls down before Jesus and told him the whole truth. Now, remember, there's a huge crowd. They didn't all disperse. This isn't a private conversation. this is a conversation in the middle of Disneyland that you're having about your bleeding. This is not a comfortable thing for this poor woman, right? And he said to her, and he uses this word, and it's important that you see it. It again connects us to the sandwich. Daughter, where is he headed? He's headed to heal Jairus' daughter. And so there's this overlapping picture that's going on here. Jairus also is in this crowd, and he's probably saying, dude, we got to go. Right? My daughter's dying. And this word is purposeful. Jesus says it, and Jairus hears it, daughter. And if he's listening carefully and watching carefully, it should cause him to relax. Because Jesus has already showed him his good intention. I'm headed to your house. I'm coming with you. Daughter, your faith has made you well, or, again, has saved you. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. What a great, great interlude. But while Jesus is still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, do not be afraid any longer. Only believe. So here you've got this recurring idea of fear and faith intermingled. Fear and faith intermingled. The woman is fearful and trembling. She tells her story. She tells the truth. Her belief has made her well, even before she tells the truth or speaks it. And here, Jesus assures the synagogue official, don't be afraid, only believe. And he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. This is an important detail. And they came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. So they've already, they've already begun funeral preparations. Because immediately upon the death of someone, you would hire the mourners to come. And they would signal what was happening. These were professionals. You hired professional mourners. They would bring flutes and musical instruments, and they would just begin to cry. It's almost like it was a performance that highlighted what was happening. And so these people have already arrived on the scene even before Jesus got there, announcing the death of the daughter. And so as they approach, obviously, the synagogue official is being challenged in his faith. He's got the news. He hears the wailers. This is not false news. This is an assurance that she's dead. It's like having the coroner make a pronouncement. She's dead. Verse 39, entering in, he said to them, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. They began laughing at him. But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. So there's five people besides Jesus and the girl in the room, a total of seven people in the room. Peter, James, and John, mom and dad, Jesus and the daughter. Now, verse 41 tells us, taking the child by the hand. Essentially, he touched her. So now we've got these things reversed. In the first story, the woman comes secretly, touches Jesus, causing him to be unclean, quote unquote. Jesus does not receive uncleanness from her, but he reverses that and heals her, makes her clean. Because when you touch Jesus, your uncleanness is removed. And here, Jesus reaches out and touches a dead person. And that, too, was an act of making him unclean. So the book of Numbers tells us this. The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. That one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died, and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. So again, you've got an extreme situation where Jesus' contact with this girl would make him unclean. Even entering into that house would have made him unclean. So he takes her by the hand. He touches her. Says these Aramaic words, which mean, little girl, I say to you, get up, or rise up. Immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old, meaning she was able to walk. She's old enough to walk. But again, highlighting this connection between these two stories, highlighting the connection to Jesus as the Messiah of Israel, and here in this story, highlighting his saving purpose. So the first story emphasizes his death, the fountain of blood, the scourging and the whipping. And the second story emphasizes the resurrection, the raising up of the dead. And immediately they were completely astounded. He gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given her to eat. So that last phrase, that last sentence is odd. It compares and contrasts with the instructions he gave the demoniac, right? The demoniac was told, go, tell everybody what's happened to you. Here, Jesus says, don't tell anyone, give her something to eat. Now, here's what you need to understand. There's so much controversy around this behavior of Jesus. Whole theologies, the messianic secret, all kinds of stuff has been raised to try to explain this. I think it's just a lot simpler than that. First of all, there's only five people in the room. All right? Jesus tells his three companions, don't tell anybody about this. Why? Eventually they do. Mark writes the story. Right? So it's not that Jesus wants them to keep it secret. It's much more practical than that. There's a big crowd outside. We're having a hard time getting where we need to go. Just keep your mouth shut about this, okay? Because we need to go. I have another place to go. In fact, he's trying to get away. So don't tell anybody about this. They'll find out soon enough. This mother and father are not going to be able to resist the temptation. And certainly the girl's going to come walking out of the room. So it seems to me it's just a very simple thing to the disciples. We need to go. Don't say anything. And they go. And he tells the parents, he gives them some instructions. Give her something to eat. Makes sense. So I think you just need to keep that very simple, and that's really all that's there, because eventually Jesus wants everybody to know the news of his healing and saving power. He's not trying to keep that a secret here. It's just a very practical instruction to his disciples who are with him and to the parents who are there, that everything now is normal. Let's get on our way. Give her something to eat. Just a marvelous story. You should just go home and ponder this and think through it, read it through again, and marvel at how Mark has put this together, how Jesus talks to both of them and does marvelous things for all of them. And I think it's important for us to see this element of touch. So we've been talking about making disciples and what that means. And here I think there's an emphasis on this personal contact with people. Touch is important. When I teach parenting classes, I talk about the importance of touch. And you know how important touch is even in your relationships. If you've been married for any length of time, you know how powerful touch can be. It can diffuse a situation. It can do so much. Touch is an integral part of human relationship. So as you start thinking about people, as you start praying for people, as you start caring for people, I think one of the things you want to think about is, do I have a level of relationship with people where I'm comfortable touching them appropriately, engaging with them, communicating to them in that touch? How are you touching people? How are you engaging people? How are you touching them? Jesus calls us to do remarkable and extraordinary things. And really, those things are exhibited through simple behaviors. He's not asking you to write a book. He's not asking you to get up in front of thousands of people and preach an incredible sermon that brings thousands of people to Christ. He's asking you to touch somebody. Just touch them. Now that's a metaphor. I mean, I don't think there's some magic. I'm just going to go walk up behind somebody and touch them. How are you seeing and then touching people? It's one of the things I try to do. You probably noticed. More than a handshake. Hand on the shoulder and passing. It's a powerful thing. When I was parenting, when I had boys, I just knew that touch was important. But boys are different than girls. So I wasn't always about hugging my boys. They didn't like that. So we wrestled instead. But there was a touch that's there. It's an appropriate touch. But I would always, when I walk by my kids, on the shoulder, touch them as I walk by. Just, there's this touch. It's not, let me kind of get by you. I don't want to touch you at all. There's always an engaging touch. And it's an incursion. It's an invasion into a space. And so you want to start thinking that way. How am I going to touch people? I don't think I've touched my neighbors. Talked to them over the fence. But I'm trying to think of when have I been in proximity to them? When have I pushed this relationship to the place where handshake, hand on the shoulder, side-to-side hug? Do I have that kind of relationship with unbelievers where it's moved from just kind of a hi, how are you, and a passing to an engagement? It relays an invasion into their space. And in that invasion of space, God reveals his power. I think that's powerful. I think that's very true. So I think about, as I pray, as you pray, engaging people at this level of saying, can I come in and touch someone who's unclean? How can I do that? Because that's what we try to avoid sometimes, is not invading that space. Father in heaven, thanks for these stories. Thanks for the love of Jesus and the power of Jesus. Thank you, Lord, for just this overcoming of distance, His invading and inviting people to be near him and close to him. And I pray, Lord, that that's what we would be about as well. As we think about people, as we think about their lives, as we think about their challenges, as we think about their hurts, as we think about their pain, their sin, their uncleanness, their brokenness, that we would come and bring a healing touch. Words of peace. A message of truth. And so, Lord, help us to touch people. And we pray this in your Son's name. Amen.